Thank you very much, Dr. Loy. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the topic assigned this evening is, shall we say, not very modest, Environmentalism for the Next Millennium. It's a long-range title that corporations don't usually find very congenial, given their myopic business strategies focusing on the next quarterly earnings. Before I get into it, though, I'd like to say that the analysis of where we're going may be very good. The technology that is available may be very applicable. The public attitude may be very conducive to dealing with these multiple forms of silent violence to human beings, flora, fauna, the natural resources of the planet, and its potential sustainability. But without an individual commitment on the part of people to become leaders in a lot of epicenters all over the world, so that they produce more leaders, so that they apply this knowledge to the empirical reality, we're going to find a very slow going, and the forces of disintegration, the forces of pollution, will outpace the forces of sustainability and benign environmental technology. So the most important, I think, thing in our discussion is to ask, what are the barriers to becoming citizen leaders in this area? One of the reasons why I worked so hard in the 70s and 60s to help start public interest research groups, which now are in over 22 states and in some provinces in Canada, is because the educational system at the college and graduate school level was seized with an indifference to developing the skills and practice of democracy, which could begin to temper and apply knowledge to the reality around it. Now, in the hard sciences, we have chemistry labs, biology labs, physics labs, and in the social sciences and humanities, we have society. Those are our labs. But the way the course curriculum developed, it was extremely vocational, job-oriented, career-oriented. It gave us the impression that questions of justice and injustice were intellectually soft questions. They weren't rigorous enough, when, of course, they are the most difficult questions and the most intellectually rigorous questions of all. It was Einstein who once said, physics is simple compared to politics. So it is important to look at your own curriculum, look at your extracurricular work, because you won't possibly be as free intellectually any time in your life, unless you really break through and pioneer, as you are when you're a student. Once you get out, all kinds of opportunity costs come in on you. Self-censorship comes in on you. There are all kinds of things that occupy your time. And you work in institutions that are fairly autocratic, such as business institutions, large companies. Whereas now you can challenge and question and think and imagine and really take advantage of it, so you might be able to change the way you live and think after you graduate. And that's why groups like Quebec PIRG are important, and the more students get involved, the more important they are. By the way, there's a table out there in the back of Quebec PIRG with a lot of materials for those of you who are interested in pursuing it further. In the States, the most significant citizen groups in Massachusetts and New York, for example, are student-funded public interest research groups with dozens and dozens of full-time staff, attorneys, scientists, organizers, writers, all of which were funded by student referendums coming in with contributions on the average of $6, $7 per student per year. So it gives you an idea of how a very little, not even a six-pack of beer, how very little in large volumes can make a major difference. In the United States, we have 13.5 million college and graduate students, which is about double the population of Sweden, and they can have a remarkably strong effect because they're near the peak of their idealism. They tend to be risk takers more than people are later in life. We've got families, and children, jobs to preserve. So you're very much given the, shall we say, the opportunity to become the engine of change. And that means that you want to develop your time more rigorously, use of your time, don't want to have your time trivialized. You don't want to implode on yourself in highly routinized patterns of going through week after week. if you want to take advantage of these kinds of opportunities. Now, onto the environmental issue. Years and years ago, it was relatively simple to talk about this because, one, we didn't know very much about it as a society, and two, there wasn't much activity, wasn't much legislation, lawsuits, marches, protests, etc. Now, to talk about it requires a sequencing of priorities in order to clarify. I mean, if you just want to define pollution's faces, you've got solid waste, and you've got water pollution, and air pollution, and herbicides, and pesticides, and you've got occupational hazards, you've got indoor air pollution, you've got asbestos, you've got mercury, and you can get more and more micro, you've got land erosion, you've got depletion of the aquifers, you've got cutting down the equatorial forests, you've got tons and tons of micro issues around which there are people working, but not that many. In our country, we have 3 million dedicated bird watchers. We do not have 3 million dedicated environmentalists who spend the same time on that subject as the bird watchers do. You know what I mean by dedicated bird watchers? Man, they copy every bird, new bird, and they can exchange ideas. They're on the internet. They travel miles to see a new bird. There was a little bird that made it across the Atlantic a few years ago. Nobody figured out how. The whole internet lit up. Cars drove planes full of people to try to see it in New Jersey, and the little thing flew to Washington, D.C., of all places. So you can see that there's a lot of opportunity here for dedicated environmentalism. You can also see that very few people have put into motion a lot of important changes. If you look at the curbs on motor vehicle emissions, you can trace it back to maybe 3-4 dozen people. Some of them working in the California Air Resources Control Board back in the 50s, a few of them working in the legal arena, some of them writing on the subject. And so you never want to give up by saying, well, you know, if we don't have millions of people on this issue, how can we break through? The reason is that environmental health and environmental issues have the greatest public support of any issues in our time. In the United States, the polls are running 80-90%. Even when the question is asked, do you want to pay more money to have stronger enforcement of air, water, pollution control laws, etc.? That is what has slowed the Republican Neanderthals in Washington who want to dismantle these laws. They realize that Republicans breathe. They drink water. And they don't like dirty, contaminated air and water. I mean, sometimes people come to awareness late in life. So that is a big start. I mean, if you were dealing with nuclear arms control, rather obscure but deadly subject, it's hard to get the public aroused on that. It tends to be more remote. Next month, NASA is going to launch another vessel in the air with 72 pounds of plutonium. And how many times are they going to get away with this? And there are some scientists who actually worked on the project who left NASA, and they started protesting. They've had news conferences in the last few days. And it's very hard to get people very upset about it. I mean, they're otherwise preoccupied with what the news has been preoccupied with in the last 2 weeks. So you see, we're starting out with a tremendous base of public support, number one. Number two, as people realize that environmental hazards are the major form of silent cumulative violence in the world, they attack the genetic inheritance, they attack the usability of air, water, soil. They basically are forms of violence that don't immediately, with few exceptions, perturb your sensory perceptions the way a approaching fire would, but they do sufficiently challenge our sense of long-range survival and provoke our minds to respond. And in that sense, it isn't as visceral as an approaching fire or crime in the streets. But once we become aware of it, it becomes very, very compelling indeed. If you look, for example, at the increasing crisis of freshwater systems in the United States, which is making us look very, very closely to Canada's freshwater resources, as is in the British Columbia, giving new meaning to the phrase drinking Canada Dry. If you look at the giant aquifers in the southeast of the U.S. and the area in Kansas and Oklahoma and others, they're being depleted rapidly. All this heavy irrigation, intensive agriculture, is coming at a price. And that could once again turn these areas into deserts unless there are huge pipelines built from British Columbia and other water-rich provinces down to the United States. You have now Asia has destroyed half of its forests in the last 30 years. What's going on in Borneo and Sarawak and other areas of Indonesia is staggering in terms of Japanese timber and other firms, just massive, massive clear-cutting with horrible silting and land erosion and species destruction. How long can this continue? In the United States, we're losing an area the size of Connecticut and Rhode Island every year to development. Malls paving over every year. That's about 4.3 million acres. How long can that continue? We try to compensate for it by making existing agricultural lands more productive. But how long is that going to be able to occur without using excessive amounts of herbicides and pesticides or taking risks with biotechnology? And of course, there's the ozone here, which Montreal is associated with the Montreal Protocol, ozone depletion. You know, back in the early 70s, the biggest issues in environmentalism was fish kills, polluted rivers, and air pollution inversions, like over Los Angeles. Those were the principal areas of concern. And look how things have changed. They then moved into drinking water contamination. They moved into pesticides, etc. And then they moved into the next stage, the more global stage, ozone depletion, the greenhouse effect, acid rain, the deoxygenation of the oceans and the decline of the fisheries. First time in history, in the last few years, a net decline in the fishery harvest. You know what's happened off Nova Scotia and Maine in terms of the prohibitions of fishing certain species. Otherwise, they would risk becoming extinct. These are species that we're used to in restaurants all over North America. So if you put it in a little perspective like that, you can see how the stakes are going up. The Amazon now is in play. In one summer, an area the size of Wisconsin was burned over by settlers that wanted to develop farms. And you know that the soil is very fragile in the Amazon, so it lasts for 2-3 years, and then they lose interest in it because it isn't as productive. It's not like deep soil in the provinces or in Kansas or Iowa. Then they burn more. Of course, we know how critical the Amazon is to the world's ecosphere. And we know what will happen if they follow the practice of what we did to our woods. We have in the United States now 4% left of our entire forest cover, a virgin forest. Of course, the timber industry says, come on, there's more timber now than ever before. Just fly over New England. You'll see a lot of old farms now grown over with trees. It's as if they don't know the difference between that kind of woods and virgin woods and what was lost in between those two transitions. One might say, well, where do we start? We have sprawl, suburban sprawl. That is a tremendous destroyer of many environments, and it's moving rapidly. You fly over Atlanta, it's got the fastest growing sprawl in North America. It's absolutely staggering in terms of the amount of acreage per person that's being allocated for this kind of sprawl. Houston doesn't even have any zoning laws. They're proud of it. They look it, too. And then we have these corporate-funded think tanks, which are not foreign to your country, which proceed to persuade us that the marketplace will handle everything. If you just let the marketplace harvest whales, you see, they'll stop at a point, because otherwise they won't have any more whales to harvest. Somehow there are certain extinct whale species that would like to have a voice in that debate. But they've gone a long way with this kind of a pseudo-cost-benefit analysis by defining the terms for us. They define what productivity is. They define what efficiency is. They define the cost-benefit formula, and it's all corporate. It's all corporate. Of course, if, for instance, we define productivity as sustaining our environment for future generations, That does not comport with the corporate short-range definition of productivity. If we define efficiency as the reduction of emphysema, cancer, and other environmentally sourced ailments, that does not comport with the corporate definition of efficiency, which is their income, profit and income statement, their balance sheet. Remember, always remember, whoever controls the yardsticks by which a subject is debated will control the debate, period. As long as our economic indices and our economic yardsticks are controlled by corporate business economists and their allies in government, we will not truly reflect the cost of the environmental depredations over time that are occurring in our society. Nuclear power is a good example of that. For instance, they would say, what is the cost benefit of nuclear power? And they would estimate it in terms of pennies per kilowatt hour compared to coal, compared to oil, compared to gas, compared to hydro. Now, for example, they conveniently left out the cost of preserving safely radioactive waste from a nuclear power plant for the next 250,000 years. They've conveniently left out until in recent years allocating from the consumer, making the consumer paying for the decommissioning of these plants, which may cost more than the plant costs to be built. Ordinary life of a nuclear plant is about 40 years. And so there are a lot of them now in the States that are heading for decommissioning. And what do you do when you got a hot plant, radioactive hot plant? Do you entomb it forever and have guards and electronic surveillance for hundreds of thousands of years? Do you break it up and try to find some salt mine or some deep underground repository? Do you distill it in terms of its radioactive residues and shoot it into space? One proposal that was made by some of our esteemed nuclear physicists years ago. What do you do with them? What are the costs there? And indeed, now you see what the costs are, because as electricity deregulation comes into play in our country, probably come in your country, that means that the electric company will no longer have a monopoly in a city, like Consolidated Edison has in New York. There'll be a lot of producers, small producers of electricity. You can even have some solar electricity produced from your building, and what's left over you can put back into the grid system. Here is the price that the electric company monopolies are making us pay for the electricity deregulation. For example, in California, in New York State already, they're saying, we will agree to allow you, the government, to change the laws ending our monopoly over the sale of electricity if you, the government, will agree to let us pass on in higher rates the costs of our stranded nuclear plants, which are no longer economic. Because nuclear plants are horribly uneconomic for a variety of maintenance, operational, inadequate capacity, etc. reasons, they can't compete in the new era of electricity deregulation. So the utility companies are saying, you have to pay tens of billions of dollars in higher electricity rates in order for us to take care of our stranded costs. So it wasn't bad enough that the taxpayer had to pay heavy into the building of nuclear plants to begin with. Government subsidies galore. Now we have to pay to have them shut down because they're no longer economic. So just in terms of the monthly electric bill, these costs are going to be extremely substantial. But they were not taken into account in the building of the plant, in the decision as, is this a really efficient way to produce electricity from an economic point of view, quite apart from an environmental, long-range radioactive waste point of view, national security point of view, sabotage point of view, transportation through towns and cities of trucks and rail cars full of radioactive materials point of view, uranium tailings point of view for the uranium miners, etc. And yet, study after study comes out from these corporate think tanks, almost an oxymoron, there's nothing wrong with anything these corporations are doing from an environmental point of view. Just recently, someone who was an apologist for nuclear power went on TV and had some plutonium here and said, look at it. This little piece of paper here can be a barrier against plutonium. That's how benign plutonium is. Can't even penetrate a piece of paper. He left out the fact that the problem with plutonium is inhaling the particles. Inhaling the particles. Not having a piece of paper be the barrier. This is what's going on. When money is attached to politicians with this kind of pseudo arguments, it begins to shape policy. If it doesn't shape policy in a affirmatively bad way, it paralyzes our ability to respond. If you look at the lack of action now on motor vehicle emissions since the fuel efficiency standard was established in the mid-70s in the U.S., requiring motor vehicle companies to achieve a 27.5 mile per gallon fleet average for fuel efficiency. There hasn't been anything since then. In fact, when the deadline was supposed to be met in 1985 under Ronald Reagan, the auto companies got deferrals for 4 years. And now the Clinton administration isn't even proposing to go above 27.5 miles per gallon, even though the Department of Transportation under Richard Nixon in the 70s stated that we should be at 45, 50 miles per gallon, and from an engineering standpoint, a much higher level is possible. And here we are frozen at that state. So we are importing over half our oil. Again, we have all kinds of trade deficits, and it is untouchable to propose in Washington that trucks, vans, and cars be subjected to higher fuel efficiency standards. What promoted it in the mid-70s? It was the gas lines, it was the oil embargo, it was the price of gasoline. Once the heat was off, there was no longer any government policy willing to push it, and General Motors and its endemic lack of toilet training ran the operation in Washington. In fact, when Reagan was elected, he gave the auto companies a wish list. What would you like us to do for you? And they said, nothing. And roll back, no more standards, and roll back the various regulations in the safety and fuel efficiency area. Now, on the other hand, there have been some pretty interesting things appearing on the horizon. One is that the scientific consensus on ozone depletion and the greenhouse effect is quite formidable internationally. Now, you still have the Wall Street Journal and a few people around universities who are trying to say that there's nothing to worry about. This is all just cyclical global activity. We've seen it before. It's no cause for alarm. When you ask these people, at what point should there be cause for alarm? Shall we say a 10% melting of the glaciers? Is that enough for you? You want to wait until something like this happens? They say, well, we can't afford it. It's trillions of dollars. And here's where we get into a more micro analysis of the problem. If we really want conventional efficiency, if we want to conserve the consumer dollar, we would want motor vehicles to be more efficient. We would want different propulsion systems. We would want solar energy that have much fewer externalities and third-order costs. By the way, they would also reduce the kind of contaminations, the kind of risks to the global issues of ozone and greenhouse effect, etc. I'll never forget when the scientists at Caltech documented that chlorofluorocarbons that were used to propel aerosols were depleting the ozone. And this was about 1973. Mind you, look who had to discover it. It wasn't DuPont that produced chlorofluorocarbons. We couldn't rely on the companies to let us know that their products were damaging the global environment. There was a couple of scientists at Caltech. Anyway, their findings were so irrefutable that DuPont couldn't rebut them. And I remember that the argument was, well, what would people do without their aerosols? Underarm deodorants, shaving cream. I mean, this is one of history's calamities approaching, you see. And someone finally put an ad on TV, and they said, we've discovered the substitution for these kinds of aerosols. So the ozone's no longer depleted. And you know what it was? The thumb. See? The thumb. I envisioned, you know, hundreds of years from now, the obituary for the planet Earth, and the tombstone would be inscribed, here lies the planet Earth, done in by trivial technology. Imagine aerosols, CFCs propelled aerosols. That is what is causing a lot of our problems. These are not non-substitutable critical technologies. These are very substitutable technologies. And in fact, substitutable technologies are in accord with the best approach to environmental pollution, which is prevention, not control. The great success stories in pollution control have not been by putting scrubbers here and putting scrubbers there, although they have helped to some extent. The great advances have been when we prohibited lead in gasoline out completely, not 20% decline, 30% decline. Tetraethyl lead out. The result, lower levels of lead in people's bodies. The second area is when we got rid of DDT in our country. Not, well, let's cut it by 50%. Out completely. The third is when we stopped nuclear bomb testing with accords with the Soviet Union in the atmosphere. That was it. Prevention. No longer, here it comes, strontium 90, the milk contamination, etc., kids, and so forth. Prevention is the first principle of environmental pollution and toxic hazards control. Removing mercury from chlorine production is another example. They removed it. It was out. And this is where we get into academic science and student advocacy, because what better place is there for finding out what the available substitute materials are and substitute technologies? For instance, the great substitute technology for coal, oil, gas, and nuclear is solar. Now you say, what kind of solar? Fortunately, there are a lot of kinds of solar. There's passive solar architecture, which goes back to the ancient Greeks and Persians who use passive solar architecture, and to East Africans who used it in the form of breezes coming off the East African coast through tunnels to cool the areas where people live. That's passive solar. It's not a brand new invention. It's the rediscovery of old knowledge. That's substitution number one. Residential and commercial construction can utilize passive solar now in much more focused and targeted ways than the ancient Greeks and Persians. The second example, of course, is biomass. That's where you take agricultural harvests and other organic material and turn it into gaseous form using existing pipelines that carry our fuel. That's another form of solar. A third is photovoltaics, whose price has been dropping precipitously in the last 20 years due to a few entrepreneurs. As Barry Commoner, the famous environmentalist from Queens College in New York City, said back in the 70s, if the Pentagon ordered photovoltaics for its more remote locations, because the most reliable form of energy doesn't require maintenance like gas turbines would, it would have created a civilian photovoltaic industry, reduced costs, and opened up civilian markets. And it would have taken a couple $100 million a year, would have done it, which is a drop in the bucket for the Pentagon. You know, the Pentagon is building a B-2 bomber, which costs $2 billion, and it doesn't fly in the rain. Did you hear that? That report came out a few days ago. The Pentagon never admitted it, but a general accounting study, arm of Congress, reported that it confuses rain clouds with mountains. And the stealth bomber has trouble flying in clouds and in the rain, etc. At $2 billion, a plane. $2 billion, a plane. You have to sink that in for a moment. Because what we're seeing with photovoltaics is the Navy now, because its budget has been restricted a bit, is applying 20,000 locations with photovoltaics for economic reasons. It's cheaper. Cheaper in part because it's more reliable. Look how long we waited for that procurement arm of the government to start building what could be one of the world's biggest industries in the 21st century, which is solar energy. When you look back at the claims that were made in energy, they're almost farcical. Academic economists after academic economists believed in the following principle. You cannot have economic growth without having energy growth. This is until the mid-70s. Anybody who said nonsense to that was hooted and laughed at by the profession because they could show curves. As long as economists can show curves, they could show curves that show every society they know of increased GNP, increased energy. And when you took that apart and said, well, what about all the waste of energy? Industrial engineers and others have pointed out that we can get along in our society with less than 20% of our energy if we had energy-efficient technology and not all that exotic. Then they started saying, well, maybe we could unlock that connection. Maybe you can have economic growth without energy growth. Well, that's exactly what has happened in our country. With modest efforts on energy efficiency, we're saving over $150 billion a year. But more important is that we have not come close to the projections of energy consumption that were made in 1970 for the year 2000. Not even close. They are projecting 170 quadrillion BTUs, 150, some scenarios went even higher, and we're not even close. As a matter of fact, the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission in 1970 said we're going to have 1,000 nuclear plants in the U.S. by the year 2000. That's 3 years from now. We have 124 declining. They're beginning to be shut down. They also told us we're going to have 100 nuclear plants in California, one every 10 miles. On the Pacific coast. How's that for a tourist attraction? They also wanted to build offshore nuclear plants. You know, four nuke packs off of Jacksonville, Florida, bobbing in the ocean. Yeah. So when anybody ever tells you that we got to listen to the experts, throw a little skepticism in that direction, because they look pretty foolish now, these nuclear physicists and nuclear engineers. One might say more than foolish. In retrospect, they almost looked like deranged scientists. And yet they came from the best universities of our country. So we have already shown that with a little effort, we can dramatically split the connection between economic growth and energy growth. The other argument they make is environmental safeguards cost jobs, which is totally false. Environmental safeguards increase jobs. If you develop, for example, a solid waste recycling program, you are increasing jobs in the local community. If you simply dump them into the pits or try to incinerate them, you are increasing health hazards in terms of water contamination underground and in terms of all kinds of dioxin and other heavy metals from the incinerators. That may increase funeral parlor jobs, but that's not the kind of jobs that we really want to see increase. Barry Commoner, again, has shown in New York City, 85% of a community's solid waste can be recycled efficiently now. Of course, we're far from that in terms of municipal organization. It's important to look back at the kind of arguments that were made and see how they played out at the present time so that we're a bit more critical about the naysayers now who keep attacking every effort of conforming human activity with benign environmental consequences. Of course, every time, you know, one issue is grappled with cognitively or civically with some success, a new corporate challenge comes on the horizon. And right now, it comes in the form of GATT and NAFTA. Now, GATT and NAFTA are misnomers when they're described as trade agreements. First of all, they subordinate consumer safety laws, environmental safety laws, and occupational safety laws in the following manner. NAFTA exempts only three international treaties that we belong to, the Montreal Protocol, the Basel Convention, and another lesser-known treaty. GATT does not exempt any. 130 countries have signed on to the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the Uruguay round, that's GATT, with the World Trade Organization, the administrative body in Geneva, Switzerland. GATT trumps all environmental treaties. It is based on the mandate of trade uber alles. That is, one country can challenge another country before tribunals in Geneva, which I'll describe in a moment, under the World Trade Organization, accusing, for example, Canada or the United States of having too stringent pesticide controls, obstructing imports of food from the challenging country that doesn't have such strict standards, or too strict standards in fuel efficiency, or too strict standards in controlling chemicals that would deplete the ozone in international trade. And guess what? The mandate of GATT is that commercial imperatives are primary, environmental consumer secondary. They're called non-tariff trade barriers. And so every year, the Western European countries, Canada, U.S., Japan, put out reports listing all the laws in other countries in the West, in Japan, that violate GATT. So we have a list of your laws that violate GATT. You do the same thing to us. You ask your U.S. embassy to give you a copy of the report. Japan does it. Europe does it. Between all these reports, there are hundreds and hundreds of laws existing in our countries, respective countries, that our allies think are GATT illegal. And a lot of these laws are, you know, economic subsidy laws and quotas and conventional trade barriers, but a lot of them are real eye-openers. They include food labeling laws, they include consumer product safety laws, they include fuel efficiency laws, etc. Under NAFTA, for example, you can legally subsidize coal and oil and gas, but you cannot legally subsidize energy conservation. Now, I wonder how that happened. Certain lobbies were busy at work. The point here is now, while we were on the verge of more and more international agreements to deal with ocean pollution and all other kinds of environmental destruction, along comes these trade uber alles, mega agreements, and there's another one coming along on investment that's going to be a big controversy next year, cooked up in secret in Europe by corporate negotiators and their government henchmen. Now there's a whole new ingredient occurring. Now, this is not to say that GATT is being enforced in these areas. In fact, we think the way to destroy GATT is to enforce it. Have them go at each other at these tribunals in Geneva. Now, if you have a courtroom here in Montreal, can you go down and sit in it? The door's open? Can the press sit in it? Okay. You have signed on to a trade agreement called GATT, along with our country, where the court in Geneva is closed to the citizens, closed to the press, no public transcript, no independent appeal, and the three trade judges who know nothing about environmental issues or consumer issues are the decision makers, and they can moonlight freely with corporations to amplify their income. There is no conflict of interest standard. Now, when I went to the New York Times and the Washington Post editorial boards, who are gung-ho for GATT, I said to them, you favor GATT? Yes, free trade is important. Got to keep up with the global competition. I said, you've been pushing free trade for 23 years, and the U.S. has generated a deficit, a trade deficit, every year, over $1 trillion. Is that how you define success? Well, things will change. I said, 23 years, this year another one, you know, over $100 billion. We've got a trade deficit with China, $54 billion, $42 billion with Japan, big one with Canada, big one now with Mexico. It's funny, all these pro-free trade advocates in the United States somehow find a way to escape their ever being wrong. But they persist, so I couldn't get anywhere on that. 23 years of evidence was not enough for those editorial writers. That's a temporary phenomenon. And so I tried another one. I said, what would happen if our courts in New York and Washington were closed to the press? Would you support the judicial statute that set these courts up? I said, absolutely not. Closed to the press? That's unconstitutional. That's undemocratic. I said, well, you can't send your reporters to the courts in Geneva. They said, well, that's the price we have to pay. So, now, that's why we really opposed GATT and NAFTA, because of the autocratic systems of governance that undermine our democratic processes, slowly dismantling, slowly eroding our democratic processes, you see? It's in its refusal to exempt international environmental treaties that really showed its corporatist hand. And by the way, they didn't even want to discuss it in the negotiations. It was a non-negotiable matter. Non-negotiable. The Indonesians and the Brazilians were not about to be told about their forestry practices. We were not about to be told about being the leading producer of certain toxics in the world because of our preeminence in the world economy, such as hydrocarbons and nitrogen oxides. And so it was off the table. Now, what is going to happen when we try to move toward more international cooperation here, when we've got this gap monster ready to collide against the moves internationally in environmental toxic control? That will be an interesting issue to look at. So how do we develop usable, practical categories here? One way is to control our own yardsticks. We must develop our own systems of measuring progress and regress, of measuring cost-benefit, of measuring productivity. It's the productivity of the world's people and the world itself that is the yardstick, not the productivity of DuPont and its balance sheet for 1998. It's not the productivity of corporations who use our air, water, and soil as their private sewers, for which they don't pay very much at all, more than they used to, but not much compared to what the damage is all about. It's the productivity that includes respect for future generations, so they don't curse us for our narcissism and our indifference to the Frankensteins in our midst, global corporations who have no allegiance to country, to community, to future generations, who are seized with one mercantile value system that dominates their horizon and drives their energy. It's very dangerous for any society to put so much power in the hands of institutions that are overwhelmingly dominated by short-term commercial instincts. We see that all the way back to the scriptures, if you want antecedents. Mammon, every major religion, has warned against over-commercialism of a society. And we are increasingly allocating enormous political, media, economic, social, and other powers, right down to the power over our children, of these commercial global entities. To say they are out of control is an understatement. They are now the government preeminent in the world. The private government of corporations is the dominant form of government. Governments are on their knees. There's no longer any other ideological challenge. The Soviet Union is no more. It used to scare a little bit some of these corporate executives to behave a bit. That is gone. There is no countervailing model of economic development that is of a magnitude and deeply rooted around the world against the corporate, multinational corporate model.